And you're all muted, as you might notice. At a certain point towards the end, we'll bring you in for questions and answers if there's questions on board. And for the moment, let's just start by arriving ourselves, taking a couple of minutes to meditate and kind of get here and be present. So just tuning in to whatever you find is divine and spending a couple of minutes just quietly arriving. All right, well, welcome everybody, and I'm going to try to get rid of that little noise that we're hearing. I think this should take care of it. All right, and welcome. My name is Dr. Claudia Welch, and I am a doctor of Oriental medicine, Ayurvedic practitioner, and author of Balance Your Hormones, Balance Your Life. And we've got Dr. Scott Blossom with us today of drblossom.com. And Dr. Scott is a licensed practitioner of traditional Chinese medicine. And he's an Ayurvedic consultant and a shadow yoga teacher. And Scott has also led some group cleanses. And we're here today to talk about group cleanses because it's sort of an unprecedented step that we're taking now to have group cleanses here in the West. This is not something we've really seen before, and so we want to talk about what's safe, what isn't. We have sort of seen something somewhat comparable before, and I'll talk about that, but let me give a minute to Scott here to just say hello to everybody, and then we'll get going. Scott, you want to say hi?
Hi, good to be here. It's nice to be hearing Dr. Claudia's voice, and I look forward to the conversation.
Me too. And sorry about that ding. Scott, are you hearing that ding, or am I the only one?
I'm hearing it. Yeah, when it seems like when people are coming on, it must be just callers coming in.
Yeah, it is, and I have made a little adjustment so that wouldn't happen, but it's still happening. So sorry about that, everybody. When someone comes in, we'll hear that little ding, and there's nothing I seem to be able to do about it right now. So hopefully that won't be too distracting. So look, here's the thing. You know, when I say this has been unprecedented, it's not totally unprecedented. Here's where we've seen something like this before. We've seen... In India, for example, we do see sort of group cleanse kind of things, but they're usually not talked about as being for health purposes. They're usually under the auspices of religion and religious tenets. So it's what I think probably happened is these rishis of old, these knowledgeable Ayurvedic practitioners of old may have said, okay, look, at change of seasons, at the time of change of seasons, it would be really good for everybody to for everybody to just stop eating complicated food for a couple of days or a month or a one day kind of thing. And so let's make this a religious premise that okay, on this particular day, you need to adhere to these religious principles, which are, having a fast, a religious fast for the day. So we see that in, when I used to live in North India, in Vasanta Panchami, there, it was the first day of spring, and everybody would eat nothing during the day and have sort of a little potato kitchery at night. And that was for religious purposes, and people didn't really think of that as doing it for their health. So it was one way to deal with mass health issues, you know, sort of social work, public health kind of things. So there would be these times that were strategically placed. And we'd have this in the month of Shravana too, and we'd have, similar things like in Ramadan and in Lent, we give up certain things, we simplify things a little bit. And so usually they're under the guise of religion, but there's a physical health purpose to them. So we have had that, but all of those, what we'll notice is that they're pretty simple. There's not, people aren't taking extreme herbs or extreme measures. And what we want to avoid doing, in my opinion, with group cleanses is to avoid any extreme measures, because returning the body to normal, to business as usual after extreme measures is a little more difficult than throwing the body into a pattern that it's not normally given to. And that should become clear what I mean by that as we go along here. One of the things before we really get into this is that I know there's a lot of you coming on who are probably practitioners, and some of you who may be coming on who are not practitioners. This is really going to be geared towards practitioners, this conversation. And so Scott and I will probably not explain terms all that much. We're really gearing this towards practitioners. But having said that, if you're not a practitioner and you're just thinking, oh, should I do one of these cleanses? I think you'll be able to follow along with the spirit of the conversation and enough to make this interesting to you. But this is geared towards practitioners so that we can really support practitioners and our profession doing these sorts of things in a safe manner. So the thing with, I'm going to assume that you all mostly know what Panchakarma is about. Panchakarma being, is about a sort of a deep cleanse. And these mini cleanses that we're doing in the West now are not Panchakarma or probably shouldn't be, in my opinion, because Panchakarma is very in-depth practice. And it's Panchakarma is a separate sort of, there's sort of separate theory behind Panchakarma than there is for the rest of Ayurvedic treatment. What I mean by that is you could be practicing Ayurveda as a general practitioner for decades, working with people, giving them in terms of giving them herbs and working with their lifestyle and their diet. But if you don't do Panchakarma, you won't understand it. It's a separate thing than giving people herbs and treating things without doing Panchakarma. And there's a reason why this is so separate, which is something that I find that we talk about very little in formal education in the States or in England or perhaps anywhere these days. And this is the direction of flow. Now, many of us know that there's five subtypes of vata, and a big part of why there's five is the direction of flow. There's udana that moves up, there's apana that moves down, there's other directions. And so we name those, and those are really important to us on a regular basis as practitioners and so forth. But there's a couple directions that we don't talk about all that much, and I want to bring those into this conversation early, because I think that it's the fundamental difference between treating with Panchakarma and treating with other things, including perhaps mass cleanses and so forth. And it's this directional flow. And when we look at this directional flow, we want to take into consideration that Ayurveda talks about three pathways in the body where disease is and where disease can occur, and simply three pathways that unite certain systems in the body. There's the Abhyantara Marga, which is the Mahasrotas, basically. It's the GI tract, and the Mahasrotas also includes Rasa Dhatu. And then we have the Madhyama Marga, which is the pathway that includes the vital organs, the heart and the lungs and the organs of the body. And so it's a deep level. Even though Madhyama means middle, it's the deepest level of these pathways. And then we have the Bhaya Marga, which includes the Shaka, the extremities, and the circulation. And so when we're usually, there's a flow that goes between these three margas, kind of joining these three pathways, the superficial pathway, the Bhaya Marga, which is circulation and so forth, the vital organs, and then the GI tract. And the flow usually, on a day-to-day basis, when we're not doing panchakarma, the natural flow is to absorb from the GI tract, absorb from the Abhyantara Marga, into the Shaka and the Madhyama Margas, into the circulation, and ultimately into the Madhyama Marga, where the organs are. So that, and the reason for this being the natural movement is that our body is always interested in receiving nourishment for these tissues, for these deeper tissues and so forth. And that's the natural flow. And there's a certain rhythm to that, a time when we have peristalsis and a time when we absorb food in through the digestive, the nourishment in through the digestive tract and so forth. And it goes in and nourishes the tissues. What we're doing with panchakarma is almost like a forced alchemy. I say that because sometimes alchemy to me seems to be you recognize and appreciate the natural flow of something, and for a particular reason and purpose in mind, you reverse that flow. And that's what we're doing with panchakarma, is we're reversing that flow. Rather than absorbing things into the deeper tissues, we're yielding, the deeper tissues are yielding stuff that they don't need into the Abhyantara Marga, into the digestive tract, and sometimes via the Bhaya Marga, right, and via the circulation and so forth, right? And we get problems if the ama and circulating excess dosha, the toxicity from the deeper tissues, that's wanting to be yielded into the digestive tract. If it gets caught in the Bhaya Marga, in the circulation, then we start seeing things like rashes and irritability and so forth. But ultimately, we really want to drive what has been stored in the deeper tissues into the Abhyantara Marga, into the digestive tract. And from there, that's when things are eliminated from because they're easily accessed in the Abhyantara Marga, in the GI tract, and from there they can be expelled. So that is a tricky part. That's a tricky part to see, how do we get the body to reverse the flow rather than absorb, to yield? How do we get the body to yield the goods? And in this case, the goods are the bads. The goods are the ama and the circulating excess dosha. How do we get the body to do that? And that's tricky. But it's nowhere near as tricky and finicky as then re-reversing the flow. In other words, returning the flow to normal. That takes time. And that is the part that is often overlooked. Like, how do you return that flow? So we'll organize this conversation today around the different aspects of panchakarma and why we're doing it. Because we want to know, here's what we want to do. We want to see, why are we doing, if we're organizing a mass cleanse for a bunch of people to do, why are we having them do each part? We really have to understand why we are doing what we're doing. Otherwise, we can make decisions that will put the body into a flow that it's not used to, and it won't fully go in that direction, or it won't fully be reversed. And that's where we get some problems, and we can talk about some of those problems that come up as we go along. You know, it sounds kind of dramatic when you hear people who do Panchakarma say, oh, don't do Panchakarma wrong because you could really hurt yourself. And the fact is if mostly you're a healthy person and you're doing Panchakarma, the chances of you hurting yourself are pretty low. But they're not nil. You may not hurt yourself in an obvious way, but things will be distorted and have trouble returning to normal. But for a small percentage of the people who are doing this, and I say small percentage because the people who are interested in doing cleanses, often Ayurvedic cleanses, often have a baseline of good health, so they may not become really injured. But if you take a mass cleanse and you pull someone in who has, for example, a diet of McDonald's and Wendy's and fast food and so forth, and they think, okay, it's time to make a change, and they come into something like this, and maybe they're not at all healthy and have high blood pressure and this and that kind of thing, if you immediately go into this, this can throw the body into some real trouble, especially if the person is low ojas, because what we need to know is that the person undergoing Panchakarma has enough ojas to be able to deal with it. Because when the toxins are yielded from the madhyama into the bhaya and into the abhyantara margas, into the digestive tract, and into the circulation, we have then obviously more toxicity circulating and irrigating our organs and tissues than we normally do. We want to have that process go on as short as possible. We don't want to keep that sort of toxic irrigation going on too long, because when we're doing that, it's going to tax the organs. And so if someone has low ojas, their organ, one of the functions of ojas is to protect the vital organs. So if ojas is low and it's not protecting the vital organs, once you've released the cows out of the pen or the wolves out of the pen, they're not protected. And, you know, the cows out of the pen, the wolves out of the pen is my sort of weird metaphor of the moment for releasing that ama into circulation. So we want to make sure the organs are going to be protected, that the person undergoing Panchakarma or a cleanse has enough ojas, enough health on board to be able to deal with that. And before we go through Panchakarma, and Panchakarma, anybody who has practiced it for a long time knows that there are all kinds of places around the world that are offering Panchakarma, and very few of them do exactly the same things the same way. So it becomes easy to think, well, anything goes. Let's just do this how it feels right or from what I know. But it's not that anything goes. There's certain principles that are really, really important. And then within that, the reason that personal attention is really needed when we do Panchakarma is that then once we really know those fundamental things that we're trying to do with Panchakarma and that fundamental reversing of flow and returning of flow to normal, then we work with people individually, and from day to day their condition can change, and what we suggest for them and the medicines that we give and the protocols that we follow will likely change from day to day. And that's a very, very tricky thing, and that's certainly not something that I think could be done effectively or safely on a mass way. So mass Panchakarma, God forbid. Let us hope that this never happens. But mass cleanses, you know, cleansing and detoxing, this kind of idea and language, this is a very Western perspective. It's not really what we talk about in India. It's like a mini cleanse. It's not really something that's been part of it's not been something that's as widespread there. I can certainly say that. So what we want to do is know why we're doing what we're doing, or why we're asking if we are leading a mass cleanse, why we're asking the participants to do them, these things. And what we want to do is choose things to do, protocols to follow, with a reason in mind, with a goal in mind, and choose the simplest way possible to get to that goal. In other words, if you can reduce ama through diet and gentle herbs, perhaps, then why try to do Panchakarma? You wouldn't want to. You know, there's times where you certainly need to do Panchakarma, but in a mask way, you wouldn't do Panchakarma. You would see, how can I reduce ama without reversing the flow, because that gets tricky. How can I deal with sort of releasing the built-up doshas from the last season without calling forth the ama from the deeper tissues and setting that whole thing in motion? How can we do this as simply and safely as possible? So what I'd like to do with the next part of this conversation is to go through each part of Panchakarma and look at, what is the purpose for this part, and is this safe to do for a mass cleanse? And so if you're a practitioner and you're leading some cleanse, and you want to know, well, is my cleanse safe? Is this good? Rather than asking that, just, you know, you can just go through, you can listen to this and go through each part and really consider, do I need this part? What am I doing this part of this mass cleanse for? What is the purpose of it, and how can I get there as simply as possible without reversing? We don't want to, in a mass cleanse kind of thing that's going on, what we don't want to do is reverse the flow, because reversing the flow is tricky and returning it to normal is even trickier. So that's what we want to avoid, I think. And before I get into all those elements, do you have anything you want to add to that general conversation, Scott?
I think the thing that you're speaking to that is really central from what my, you know, emphasis in having been involved in doing this, and actually even last year having been involved in doing a very simple version of Purva Karma through the Yoga Journal that had over 30,000 people, you know, participate in a short period of time, you know, with relatively, you know, we didn't have any real problems, but it was probably because we constructed it in a way that we were minimizing those possibilities, and like you said, working with a crowd of people who were generally already very health motivated and, you know, fairly balanced. So they weren't, it wasn't an all comers thing. It was a very self selected group of yoga enthusiasts who were already fascinated by diet and probably already doing their own kind of version of healthy eating and healthy living. So one of the things that I've seen over the years that is really, I think, important to acknowledge is that the most common mix of signs and symptoms that if somebody comes in to see me as a patient with is a mixture of deficiency and excess. And that because of the speed of life and the sort of cultural mass level vata imbalance that we have in America, the process of working with a mixture of, say, excess vata, which is going to create deficiency with agni, and then secondary effects that go along from, less than optimal digestion, is that people have to be handled gently. And that it was something Dr. Svoboda and I talked about maybe 10 years ago, which was, well, it would be really great to emphasize a lifestyle for, you know, in this case, yoga practitioners, hatha yoga practitioners, that would be vata balancing, and then something very, very gentle and nourishing that would, like you said, reduce the ama on the surface of things and gently introduce that shift in habit and behavior and diet in a way that wouldn't be too shocking, but would nonetheless still communicate the same thing to the person's tissues and communicate the same thing to the person's psyche, that it is, a good idea to change things up and eat in a way that's healthy and live in a way that's healthy, but at the same time, it's also rigorous. You know, even making little changes in your exercise patterns and your sleep patterns, eating a nutritious diet that's different from your, you know, familiar diet, all of those things have to be adjusted to, and that process, like you were saying, it affects the flow of things, because even when people are not necessarily having the best set of habits, they become accustomed to them, and then their flow and their, you know, their lives and their internal circulation is really accommodated around that. And so this is You know, that I think it's a, you know, you're making great points, and that the emphasis that I came to it from, you know, with, you know, sagely influence of Dr. Sobota was, you know, let's make this really, we can make this extremely gentle and still have it be quite effective and actually profound for people, because simply making the change itself without doing anything drastic like reversing the flow or anything close to Panchakarma type of activities is going to be effective, but more importantly, introduce the experience in a way that's integratable, and then as people repeat that process, they may at one point become interested and even more importantly, actually prepared to go through, you know, a residential program of Panchakarma therapy.
I really agree, and not and if they can't afford to go through a residential form of Panchakarma, there are home Panchakarma like protocols that you can do if you have good guidance from a practitioner who knows you well and is on call for that. You know, one of the things I like in terms of this idea of doing something for the masses or on a big group level is the recognition that not everybody can afford to go someplace and do sort of a residential Panchakarma, but that doesn't mean that we do some half-baked thing at home and get ourselves into more trouble. And one of the things that you're saying, Scott, that I think is important to emphasize is this a culture of the extreme culture that we're living in. In other words, a culture that appreciates extreme things and feels like nothing is happening unless it's extreme and dramatic. You know, there's, and this is probably not limited to the U.S. This is, you know, this is something, for example, in India, many doctors know that they have to bring a syringe with them and when they go to see someone, because if they just give them an herb without giving them an injection, the person wants an injection. They're like, where's my injection? Where's the pain? And if they feel like there's pain and there's an injection, that's something dramatic enough that they feel like, okay, I've been treated in some way. But in the States, you know, if you don't fast on nothing and then purge and then have enemas and stuff, you feel like nothing's happening. But, you know, one of the things that has struck me occasionally is that the most extreme thing you can do these days is to do less rather than more, because everybody's going in this direction of extreme, following and chasing the extreme and feeling like nothing's happening when there's less movement going on. But it's in that very space and time where there's less movement and less happening where really profound healing can happen. And a long time ago, even with Panchakarma, I started feeling like the less is more approach is very, very, very valuable to Westerners. And sometimes I think the Panchakarma programs that we have available to us in the West, when we know as practitioners some of the things that go on in India that are more extreme, we think, oh, we have such a watered-down version of Panchakarma here. But I actually think that for the Westerner, sometimes that quote-unquote watered-down version is more effective than something more extreme, simply because we have a pattern that needs to be, that we have a pattern of appreciating extremes. And if we can break that pattern to doing something simple, amen.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, Scott, I think you're going to have a lot to say about all of these little parts. So let's get of Panchakarma. So let's get to it. And the overall thing here is that we call a whole series of practices Panchakarma, but really it's broken into three sections: Purva Karma, Pradhana Karma, or you could say Panchakarma, and Paschata Karma. Purva Karma is what happens literally before the Panchakarma, which is the Pradhana Karma, the main karmas. And then there's the Paschata Karma. Paschat means after, so it's literally what happens after the Panchakarma. So let's go through these things kind of one by one and look at which one of these things can be appropriate in a mass cleanse, and what are their purposes? And this is really an interesting conversation, because I think even those of us who have studied Panchakarma theory it's interesting to explore why we're doing some of these things. And it's some of them have interesting depths that we can go to. So Purva Karma, let's take Purva Karma first. Purva Karma, literally before the karma, before the Pradhana Karma, before the five actions that we take, is preparing the body. The whole point of Purva Karma is preparing the body for the Pancha Karma. And so it, the first things are Dipana and Pachana. These are the first things we do. And practitioners who I know who are specializing in Pancha Karma will do Dipana and Pachana, in kindling Agni and digesting Ama at least for 2 weeks before Pancha Karma begins. And so I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, Scott. When I was in practice and I would have people do a home Pancha Karma, because that's mostly what I would do is work with them to do that. And it would, I never did a mass thing. I'm not saying there's not a place for a mass thing, but I think there is no place for a mass Pancha Karma. But with a home Pancha Karma, I saw things work very well with a close connection. I knew my patient very well and what was going on. I would never, ever have them do Pancha Karma if they weren't already established in an appropriate dinacharya for themselves, appropriate daily routine, appropriate diet, both for their constitution and for their current condition. If they had those down, and you know, really had those down, and it wasn't a strain for them, then I would think this was a good idea. So the first thing I would do is make sure that they could live and eat appropriate to their constitution, because we've got to remember that when some a huge change for somebody might be eat mostly whole, freshly cooked foods. That might be a huge change. They might have a long history of predominantly processed foods and in their history. And if they've got that, they can really go into shock, in a sense. Go just going off that is a lot. What you run into is people hitting emotional walls that happen because of breaking addictions, because their whole being has been addicted to certain foods. So just getting them off processed foods and onto whole, freshly cooked foods, that right there, done long enough, can help Agni and can start to digest some of the ama that's going on. So that's the first thing. And then there's some other little things we can do. But what are your thoughts on that, Scott?
You know, exactly. That's the big thing, is that if they're already established in either being accustomed to eating that way, just, or you know, leading, having their dinacharya very well established, or they are somebody who has consciously sort of gone on the straight and narrow for, you know, during seasonal junctions, you know, and done maybe, you know, 2 weeks of a more strict dinacharya, and then they kind of loosen things up a little bit, and they're aware of, you know, what the vices and spices in their life are that they're allowing back in, and, you know, just if they're, you know, fluent with being able to go between those two states, or they just are living in a more kind of strict, with a more strict dinacharya, that's absolutely the foundation. And that one of the other factors that, you know, that I've observed over the years is that having people ease their way into it, where they do a really simple elimination diet, and then they're starting to reduce the caffeine for at least a week before they start to even do what would be sort of Purva Karma type of activities, where it's almost like a preparation for Purva Karma, addresses that for Americans. So I love what you said about, you know, doing that for a couple weeks is a great idea, because if somebody is new to it, it gives the transition both physiologically and psychologically into what would be the straight and narrow for them. And then also it allows for some of the influences, either chemicals in food or stimulants they might be employing, like caffeine or, you know, tobacco or something like that, to be reduced, so that there isn't such a strong reaction or shock to going into a kind of a cleansing situation that would be, you know, Purva Karma-esque.
Well, I love what you said about it's sort of it's actually the prelude to Purva Karma. It's not even really Purva Karma. It's the preparation for the preparation. And
exactly.
and that is something I think that you could do in a mass way. You could say, you know, you can outline sort of an appropriate daily routine that's not likely to get anybody into trouble. But that's not to say it's easy, because if someone, just take a simple example, if someone is addicted to cigarettes, part of the preparation for the preparation is to lose them. That can take a long time.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, that when you were doing your mass cleanse with the yoga journal, was there anything saying, hey, you shouldn't do this if you smoke? Or, you know, it seems to me that the preparation for preparation, even if someone can't give up cigarettes or alcohol, if they are doing the other part of it, if they're doing a whole foods diet and having a routine with a certain amount of yoga, that's going to be beneficial. They may not want to go further than that, but doing cleaning up. In fact, many times with patients, what I would have them do is, if they were serious about quitting smoking or drinking, is to get the rest of their life in order first, so that they've got their diet down and their lifestyle down, so that it can support them coming off of it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And what we did for that one is we sent out a note about 3 weeks ahead of time saying, now's a good time to really, you know, like, acknowledge that you're about to do this. So it was the prep for the prep, and we told them about 3 weeks. And what a big part of it, too, was telling them to inform all of their community, you know, their family and friends that they're interacting all the time with, that I'm going to do this and I'd like your support, because it's, you know, kind of the AA factor in a sense, like where support itself is such a tremendous factor in actually somebody being able to make some of those harder changes for things that they may be addicted to, or, you know, habituated to in a way that's going to be uncomfortable to, you know, reduce or eliminate from their habit.
Yeah, and you know, you said the word support, and I think that's one of actually the beauties of the mass cleanse movement, is that many of them encourage support among the people who are interaction and camaraderie amongst the people who are doing the cleanse, and that group support seems to be very useful for people.
Absolutely.
You know, we're all getting up. Go ahead.
Oh, just things like Facebook, or, you know, that was one of the first times I think I truly appreciated it.
Yeah.
Because it was so easy to have things happening in a more or less, you know, responsive fashion without it being one email for one person's comment and the kind of privacy of that. You know, it was the kind of thing where somebody is sharing, you know, their reaction or whatever, and there's probably a number of people that are having, you know, milder versions of the same thing or maybe the same kind of thing. So then you can supply, you know, you can communicate to them knowing that other people are being able to compare notes, and it does feel like it's a form of support, because there's an openness about we're all in this together. You know, this can be, you know, more difficult than one might think.
Right. Right. All right. So one of the things people can do, I think we can probably agree on this, is that if people are doing a mass cleanse kind of thing, the first thing is the prep for the prep, which is to make sure that people are cleaning up their diet, getting rid of the poisons in their lives for, say, 2 or 3 weeks before they even start this. Would you agree?
Absolutely.
All right. So which is nice. I mean, that might sound like, oh, gosh, we can't even get to it until then. But you just say 21-day cleanse instead of a 5-day cleanse, right? And the first 2 weeks are just about getting rid of the poisons in your life. So Dipana and Pachana, then, are Purva Karma. And Dipana and Pachana, simply cleaning up the diet and having a daily routine that's appropriate, will help Agni become better established. Our purpose in mass cleanses would not be to reverse the flow and return the flow like we talked about earlier, but more to make the natural business as usual model of of absorbing from the abhyantara into the madhyama margas, from the digestive system into the deeper tissues and nourishment, to make that flow better, to heal that flow, not change it, but to heal it and improve it and maximize it, its potential. And so in that case, Scott, did you do any kind of dipana or pachana kind of thing with the yoga journal? Do you think there's a place for that in a mass cleanse, like taking a little ginger tea or cumin, coriander, fennel tea on a daily basis or something like that?
We did do that, yes. We were using basically, you know, people would divide themselves along the lines of either ginger turmeric type people during it, or they were going to be cumin, coriander, fennel people. And then with the kind of prep for the prep period, we were encouraging people to do things like drinking 4 ounces of pomegranate juice a day, or having ginger tea, you know, starting to have ginger tea on a daily basis, and also things like just sipping hot water, you know, at regular intervals during the day.
So you had a way of having of making it easy for people to sort themselves into either the ginger turmeric category, or if they had a little too much heat going on in their system, then cumin, coriander, fennel?
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, through questionnaires or something like that.
Yeah, and you know, and one other thing we started to encourage people to do, which this is a whole another subject, so I'm not going to really, you know, go on at length about it, but you know, the clearing up of the internal organs, like one thing that we're doing right now is we're having people, you know, consume ginger, carrot, burdock, and beet, you know, like whole, and cook it as part of a meal, you know. And so for the prep period, they're now starting to have more of those things, just as a way to gently encourage the liver to detoxify with whole foods without really making huge changes in you know, other parts of the diet. It's like the one thing we're having them add, and that nowadays the internal organs are one level, but there's so many things that, you know, would fall under the category of what the Chinese would call gu and what the Ayurvedans would call krumi, you know, where it's worms is the, you know, literal translation, but it's kind of stuff that operates at more of the cellular level. And so getting things to penetrate into, you know, cleaning up the blood, cleaning up the rasa, like ginger tea and, you know, fennel and pomegranate, that kind of stuff is... And then also probiotics, and that's what I wanted to bring up. So we were also recommending that people do actually, in the prep period, they start doing probiotics. They also possibly start doing some you know, kind of Western fungal defense is one product that I really liked. It's from the company Garden of Life, which is a, you know, it's a natural product. It's not a drug. But anyway, just getting into kind of affecting things at the level of what you might call you know, systemic fungal kind of disorders, which is really under the category of goo or krumi, where you're trying to affect a change in the blood level, but really it's to try to communicate at the cellular level so that the organs are being, you know, the organs are being supported by elimination diet and some of the dipana and the pachana practices, but those things are then enhanced in specific ways, and even in some cases with things that are outside of Ayurvedic, kind of traditional Ayurvedic stuff, like using modern probiotic therapy to you know, influence the pollen in that direct way because of the effect on the cellular level.
And I just want to point out that for everybody, in case they missed that, is Dr. Scott said, you know, cooked ginger and carrots and beets and something else, I think, but it was cooked. It wasn't raw juice. You know, in Ayurveda, we pretty much never say raw juice is good for everybody across the board. I know that's really a popular thing right now, but in Ayurveda, we wouldn't necessarily advocate that for everybody.
Uh-huh.
So dipana and pachana is something on a level that we seem to be able to do pretty safely on a mass level. Then the other big part of purva karma is internal oleation, internal snehana. And I love my friend Sharon Jackson, who who is a Panchakarma specialist in the UK, I love how she talks about the purpose of internal oleation. Because when I started thinking about internal oleation, then I kind of couldn't remember how I was taught it, and you know, something about, you know, okay, you're preparing the Abhyantara Marga for the dump of the toxicity from the deeper organs, and all right, but is there what else is going on here? And so I talked with Dr. Svoboda last week or so when we knew we were going to do this conversation, and we were having this conversation about mass cleanses, and basically I realized that both of us were thinking of this in kind of a way that I think would be really hard to defend but it's the way we were thinking of it, which is, it's slickifying the whole Abhyantara tract, right? The whole marga, it's making it slick. Then the toxins come out. They have nothing to stick to. They move right through. That's one thing. And even though it's just a funny way to look at it, I think that is part of what's happening. One of the things I love about the way Vagbhat talks about oleation is, you know, what to speak of a human being, even a board, even a dry board, can become flexible when you give oleation to it, when you apply steam and when you apply oil specifically. And so it also softens the tissues. So that's two things it does. It's said to liquefy the doshas, the circulating doshas. So it kind of makes everything easier to flow out. But then there's this other way that my friend Sharon Jackson talked about it, which I just love. She said, you know, her main purpose, the way she sees internal oleation, and this is things like, of course, having 2 tablespoons of ghee the first day and 4 the second and 6 and then 8 and whatever. One of the big things she sees in terms of its value in Panchakarma is that it brings a full stop to business as usual. And that's what she wants to do. She said, that's what I want to do. I want to bring a full stop to business as usual. It does smush the Agni, but in a sense, that's almost a good thing, because during Panchakarma, the person is going to eat very little. They have little Agni and appetite anyway, because there's going to be ama circulating in the tissues. And she doesn't want the person to be shoving food in their mouth, and the way she put it, having it come out their bum all the time. You know, she just wants to give the digestive system a rest while this is happening, and it just throws the blanket on hunger. So it just brings everything to a full stop. And what that is talking about is exactly what we talked about in the beginning of this conversation, is there's the normal flow. Internal oleation, that's where you bring a full stop to the normal flow and prepares the way for the reversal of the flow. One of the things she said, you know, this is her exact quote, she said, it's amazing the deprivation people can cope with when they have a little oil. And when people are going into Panchakarma and having khichdi, nothing but khichdi, especially if we've had been addicted to certain things, that can be emotionally very difficult, unless you don't want it. Unless you don't have a desire for it. And what one of the side benefits of that internal oleation is it just brings the cravings to a halt often. So it really brings things to a full stop, and I love that. And personally, I feel that because it brings things to a full stop, you are starting to mess with the flow. You're starting to mess with the natural flow, and that's what we don't want to do in mass cleanses. So that's not, I don't feel that there's a place for internal oleation to that degree, to the degree that we do it with Panchakarma in mass cleanses. And Scott, love to hear your opinion on that.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the whole thing, is I remember the first couple times that I did it, and this was with a group, but it was patients of mine locally, and it was, you know, small groups, maybe 12 people, and we were meeting 5 times during, you know, over an 8-day period or 9-day period when people were going to go through it. And, you know, I was having them do, you know, successive amounts of ghee. You know, they'd increase the amounts of ghee to do the internal oleation, and people, they were really surprised at how intense the experience was. And then it made me pause and think, well, I've got this is a small group. If this got any larger, this could be, you know, I wouldn't necessarily be as responsible or responsive as I would need to be to help people, you know, support people through this. So then what I did at that point was to take out that step and then increase the amount of ghee in the khichdi that they were eating. So it was a sneaky way of flickifying the the GI tract, but also not having them actually swallowing, you know, quantities of ghee directly in the morning with the direct, you know, intent of smooshing the agni, as you put it. You know, so basically people, when the agni goes down, they feel really different, and they have to, at some level, they need, lots of times they're going to need interpretation and support for that experience, and to understand that what you're doing is, like you said, you're intentionally bringing the flow to a halt, which is very strange because you know it's happening, but it registers physiologically and through sensation, through emotion, and, you know, through the way your mind is operating, and it's all these things that you assume that, oh, I'm just going to affect Agni, but Agni is in, you know, inextricable from everything that goes on in your life, so it affects everything in the way that you feel, and people in a group that is, I don't think it's really possible to do it, you know, responsibly. I think it's best to, you know, like I said, what I did is a kind of a halfway thing, and it is to increase the amount of ghee in the actual khichdi a little bit so that it was being, you know, the internal GI tract was being treated that way as opposed to a more heroic amount of ghee being ingested.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if your purpose is to reverse the flow, then you've got to do this step. If your purpose is not to reverse the flow, it would be best not to do this step. And then you think, you know, then there's this question, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this too, Scott, you know, when I worked with Dr. Laud's place in the Panchakarma department, there was ghee in the khichdi all through Panchakarma. But I know that there's other practitioners in the U.S. who advocate a no-fat khichdi during Panchakarma. And I talked to Dr. Svoboda about this a little bit, and Dr. Ram Kumar as well. And what I recall, and Dr. Ram Kumar is the head of Vijayagrama, this Ayurvedic eco-village in India, and they do beautiful work there. And they use very little, if any, fat in their food during internal oleation. I'm not sure about other times. And during internal oleation, I certainly understand that. And then, you know, so the question is, well, why either to use ghee in khichdi or why not? And I think the practitioners who are advocating no fat in the food are having fat at certain times and no fat at other times in order to stimulate the bile ducts or something like that, which is not quite something that we look at in Ayurveda, but it's not to say that it's not a valid viewpoint. That might be a more Western viewpoint. So we want to look at why we're doing something, and if we can justify why we're doing it, that's what counts. For me, I think if part of the purpose of doing a mass cleanse is to enhance and better the natural flow of things and not to reverse it, then I think using some ghee in khichdi is good. It's nice for Agni, and it doesn't stop business as usual.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I think you're right, and that's the thing, is when you start shutting the valve off and turning the valve on, meaning you're taking fat or reducing it really significantly in the diet, there's going to be the recognition of that from the tissues is going to be it's going to be toward the extreme end of application, whereas you keep it in there, and it's you know, the term snehana implies a kind of love, and so there's a real soothing quality too. And with vata being high, in generally everybody nowadays, the, you know, snehana is, I think, extremely important to keep people from going into the fear and anxiety that go along with, kind of, that are endemic with that.
Yeah. And one thing I want to say is that, you know, snehana doesn't just relate to love, it means love, you know, so snehana means love, and when we have that oil, it gives the physiological experience of love. So we want to do things that are less extreme. You know, the less extreme, the better for this, I think. And, of course, this is just my opinion, but it is my opinion. So I think we're probably good for that internal oleation. I want to move along here a little bit. And then we really start working with the Abhyanga and the Svedana. So Snehana and Svedana, external Snehana, the Abhyanga, the warm oil application on the body, and the Svedana. And these really start working with, you know, massaging the tissues and softening them with the oil and the steam, allows those toxins to move out. Now, this works in two different ways depending on the context. If we have reversed the flow, it really allows those toxins to yield into the digestive tract. If we haven't reversed the flow, we still can do an Abhyanga every day as part of a regular daily routine, but it's just not going to be getting to the depths that it would. We're not looking in a mass cleanse. We wouldn't be looking for getting the old toxins out of the deeper tissues. That's probably not an appropriate goal for a mass cleanse without personal direction. What's more realistic is over the past course of this past season, heat has built up or cold has built up, and we'd like to get rid of that. And so I think that Abhyanga actually, is absolutely fine to do on a mass level. And in fact, it's part of normal dinacharya, normal daily routine in terms of an ideal Ayurvedic protocol. So I think that can be done very well. It's just going to have a different effect because you don't have the, usually in a mass cleanse, you're also not going to get too into Svedana. And what I do want to say about Svedana, sweating, is if I did include sweating at all in a mass cleanse thing, I would never give, say, a set number of minutes to do it, because my overwhelming experience has been that everybody can tolerate heat to different levels. And as soon as, so if you're using Svedana as like a hot bath or a hot shower or a steam box, to get out as soon as you want to, as soon as you feel the urge to get out, get out. Do not make yourself stay in there longer, because then you're starting to go towards depleting yourself. So I think that at least Abhyanga has a place in mass cleansing, and it certainly has a place in Panchakarma, but I think it can be used safely in mass cleansing. Of course, in Ayurveda, we say that during a woman's period, she should not do Abhyanga, but many women have really dry skin, live in dry climates, etc., and it may be they don't want to give it up, and so for them, just a light application of oil is fine, but not a massage during that time. So, you know, this is another thing to take into consideration with mass cleanses, is that is during a woman's cycle is not a great time to do that. So anything you want to add about Abhyanga and Svedana?
No, I think that I'm in agreement with what you said, and nothing to add.
Okay. So then we've released all the toxins from the deeper tissue, or a bunch of them, maybe not all of them, but a bunch. We've reversed the flow successfully. The flow is now coming out. Now is the time for the Panchakarma, which literally means five actions, which those five actions are listed differently in different texts, but let's just say sort of the enema, the busti, the virechana, which is purgation, the vomiting, which is vamana, and let's, for these purposes, use nasya and rakta moksha. Rakta moksha, nasya is the nasal drops and nasal cleansing kind of things, and rakta moksha is bloodletting, which would just be a small amount of blood. It wouldn't be like medieval times, right? We're not talking about take out a quart of blood and see how you feel. But these things are done in the context of Panchakarma in a very, very specific way and very tailored to the person, and also day to day might change a little bit. And so these are things we certainly do not want to encourage in mass cleanses. However, there are certain ones that, you know, for example, the occasional oil or decoction busti can be used certainly outside of Panchakarma for regular treatment purposes, but that's not something I would include in a mass cleanse. I wouldn't include. The only kind of purgation thing that I would possibly include is maybe a little bit of triphala or amalaki. Maybe amalaki, because it would be more appropriate maybe for everybody. Triphala is a if there's really high pitta, then we'd have people do amalaki. So if you want to do a one thing across the board, it might even be better to do a little amalaki than to have triphala for everybody, because triphala is a little too heating for some people. And I think nasya has a place. I think doing a neti pot and nasya could work. Those two things could work. A little bit of gentle kind of amalaki thing and nasya, those could work. The other ones I wouldn't introduce. Would you, Scott?
No, I agree entirely with that.
Okay. And then paschata karma, and I wonder if you can talk about paschata karma and things. I mean, for me, the main thing with paschata karma is you've now succeeded in killing the Agni and you have reversed the flow. Paschata karma is really about bringing the flow back to normal and having the person stay on a really simple diet for a while, khichdi with ghee kind of thing, and then add some steamed vegetables, add some soup after a little while, and follow the Agni out. So in other words, as the appetite returns, you can slowly increase the complexity of your diet. But to jump out of Panchakarma and go back into, this is why it's so important to only have people go through Panchakarma who already know how to eat and live, so that on the other end they go back into that rather than having to learn at this vulnerable time where you might be feeling a little crappy in one way or another, to having to learn how to eat and live at this point. It's impossible. So
right.
Yeah, go ahead, Scott.
No, I agree, and I think that's what I found in the sort of mass context. You're going to be working with a group or you're going to be online, is that it's really important to emphasize that there's sort of two pathways to rejuvenation. One is with substances and, you know, lifestyle disciplines, and one is without substances, which is just really lifestyle. So it's a way of, you know, the way that we've translated it to people is what you've been doing with your lifestyle is probably going to have, you know, a more profound effect on helping you to rejuvenate than anything else, especially because of the prevalence of Vata and the lifestyle rhythm and routine being, you know, the most direct way to assure that the circulation of the prana within the system is going to be, encouraged in a good way. And that it's not rocket science, and it's not this fancy thing where you have to go buy a bunch of special herbs, etc. You really, at some level, it's rigorous enough for people a lot of times just to stick with what feels like a much more moderate lifestyle, you know, a much more balanced lifestyle from an Ayurvedic perspective, but nonetheless, much being moderate is not the norm nowadays, and people suffer because of their habituation to having a more extreme kind of rhythm and routine in their lives, and so that the rejuvenation without substances is a great safe way to take people in a group who you may not even be seeing face to face because you're doing it, you know, via a virtual connection, through the process of rejuvenation, where they're really getting the heart of the message, which is that this can be done simply by, dinacharya.
Right. And what we're talking about here is, in great measure, medicine of elimination rather than addition, medicine of subtraction rather than addition, taking away the poisons of the life, taking away the excess busyness, taking away processed foods, taking away addictions, and maximizing, and there's this word I keep looking for this whole hour. I've been looking for this word and I can't find it. But anyway, maximizing, enhancing, the natural flow, fixing that. That's what we're looking at. So it's not focused on taking a bunch of stuff and doing a bunch of stuff, but getting rid of a lot of stuff. So I think anything else you want to say about paschata karma and that the importance of that, Scott?
Well, I have a question for you, which is, I think that, you know, the kind of the like you said, the idea of reversing the flow is where you're kind of drawing the line in the sand, which I think is it's such a great point. And that the whole idea of Utkrishta is about getting the dosha to return to its home site. So you're sort of fomenting it, but in the areas where the various panchakarma therapies can be effective to get it to leave, you know, you can kind of suddenly eject dosha from the system. And it seems that purva karma has so the question is, do you think that purva karma alone has the effect of kind of getting, by reducing dosha and balancing things out, has the effect of kind of encouraging the dosha to move back to its home site? And then how would the pushchat karma be, if you're going to simply do purva karma, which I think we've agreed that is probably as far as is appropriate to go.
Well, not the whole way, because internal oleation is included in purva karma.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
That's what brings to the full stop. So we don't want to go that far.
Right.
You know, just doing some light deepana and pachana without the internal oleation, I think, is good. But we're not really completing purva karma there, because we're
right.
not using the internal oleation, right?
Right. Agreed completely. And so in terms of the process of getting, you know, of Utkrishta, how do you see that working in a group setting, in a setting, like you said, where you're actually not even actually going through full purva karma, and what are the consequences of that?
I'm not sure we need to make the doshas Utkrishta in the case of mass panchakarma. We don't really need to ripen them to get them out. We just need to, I think it's more of a supporting Agni, and if we support Agni and simplify the diet, right, and get away from stresses and allow the tissues to relax, that the Agni will then not be, see, Agni on a regular basis is having to deal with whatever food we put into it. Then if there's circulating doshas, whatever the doshas are, it has to get through that. And then it has to get through medicine. So if we can return Agni to normal by getting rid of lots of food, having light diet with khichdi, which is part medicine, part food, then it still has to get through the khichdi, but the khichdi is also supporting it in a certain way. And it has to get through the dosha. So if we simply simplify the diet and support Agni, it will be free enough after a couple of days to be able to get through some of the circulating dosha. And so it will just do that on its own. We don't have to do anything to that dosha. It will just automatically get its whatever's in circulation will get dealt with by Agni. And
mm-hmm.
and I think klishtaizing it is unnecessary at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So does that answer? Yeah.
It does, yeah, absolutely, and I think, yeah, it's been a subject of conversation. So, no, that was,
yeah.
I agree, and that's what I've observed too. That it doesn't take dramatic things to
right
the body. Yeah.
And I think that's sort of the bottom line here. That, and you and I are agreeing right down the road, right down the line on that. So, just as a sort of a quick recap, if we look at purva karma as being dipana, pachana, and internal oleation. There is a place in mass cleanses for dipana and pachana things, and that can be done simply through diet or very gentle teas, ginger, turmeric, cumin, coriander, fennel, certain dietary things like Scott was talking about, cooked ginger, carrot, beet kind of things. That's possible. So that's possible. Internal oleation really does not have a place in mass cleanse, I think, because you're bringing a full stop. And getting the body out of that full stop is difficult. So then we get into the panchakarmas, and there may be a place for nasya and very gentle purging herbs like amalaki or something like that. I'm not saying these are the only possibilities, but just giving an idea, right? And then paschata karma is something that that even with a mass cleanse, we want to we want to look at, okay, at the other end of this quote-unquote cleanse that we're doing, whatever dietary things we're doing, we still want to not jump right back into complicated food. We want to go back into, gently back into our regular dinacharya and gently back in and follow our agni out of the swamp. And so, in other words, again, as agni increases, and we can tell that by our appetite increasing, we can start having slightly more complicated food until we're back to normal. And yeah. Scott, in terms of when you did the mass cleanse thing with Yoga Journal, did you address paschata karma in some way?
We did in a very mild way, and that was probably the aspect of what we did that was the least thorough, in the sense of we gave them kind of guidelines, but there wasn't an ongoing forum. And so that was the big message back was, let's try to be more, more complete with the follow-through, so that there's the subjects are being addressed, more. And so we did another one, which you were generous enough to offer some of your prana meditations to with Yoga International. And we actually partnered with Whole Foods, and we had a much more significant kind of follow-up where there was a lot of resources about, doing, paschat karma in a very general sense of eating light foods before heavier foods, and, continuing with the lifestyle and the yoga practice. And I think the main thing is that nutritional theory, which is so inculcated in everybody's thought, whether in the Western, of course, the United States, health world. So whether you're a student of Ayurveda or not, that the concepts and the structure and the manner of logic is really, really deeply ingrained. And what it's done over time, one of the negative side effects is it's moved people away from feeling to thinking about their diet. And so what you just said, and to kind of amplify that, is that you actually have a very clear feeling. It's a sensation. It's a quality of hunger. It's a quality of being ready to ingest something heavier, and there's a strong desire. It's very clear when you're ready to eat something heavier. And if you're working from that perspective of, I'm going to honor the wisdom of the Agni within me, and as it speaks, it's needs more intensely for heavier foods, then I will satisfy that. But if it doesn't, I'm going to be able to hold myself back from feeling whatever logic might be going in my mind, like, oh wow, I really need to eat more protein, because that's a big thing in nutritionism, is the hyper emphasis on protein consumption, and people really worrying if they don't eat protein for 3 days that they're going to end up somehow falling dead from protein deficiency or something. And and basically that we can go for a week or even 2 weeks on a very low protein diet and benefit from it. And then, movies like Forks Over Knives have shown very clearly that, the sort of percentage of protein intake in the diet is directly correlated to the potential for cancer and things like that. So that this also invites the person into adjusting their orientation to what it is to feel good. Feeling good is an innate thing, and it's an immediate thing. You know what it is, but you've just done something intentionally to not so much reduce vitality, but like you said, to sort of reduce the agni, and you get a certain benefit from that. But as the agni starts to rise back up, your vitality is going to, have very clear internal signs that is occurring as well, and those things will be the green light for for consuming heavier foods. So then the other side of it, because I, practice a lot of hatha yoga, and the shadow yoga has got a lot of, we use the Uddiyana Bandha Kriya, which is in the family of Agni Sada and Nauli, and Nauli being a word that indicates the way that they used to stir the ashes at the Vedic sacrifices. So you're using you know, deep abdominal movements with the abdomen, and not to be confused with locking or squeezing anything, because that's really the opposite of helping the flow and the suppleness of the internal organs and the circulation of the internal organs, but skillfully finding ways to actually massage your own abdomen with your abdomen while you do an exhale retention. And, you know, these are things that really need to be learned from somebody who's practiced them a long time and has a great deal of skill with them, because it's very subtle work. So there's a lot of room for interpretation and misinterpretation of what it is. And then, unfortunately, the word that got associated with Bunda is lock, when it's actually, I think, more accurately something that has to do with intimacy. Like the word bundu, it means your buddy, it means your friend, and bunda is cognate with that same word. So it's like the bunda, when you draw the navel back and in, is very much like, you know, becoming more intimate with the sensations inside of your abdomen, the GI tract, the internal organs, so that you can have a more direct relationship with reading the signs about when, you know, you can make the diet heavier and more complicated, as in the case with Paschit Karma, or just generally speaking from day to day, where you can read the signs and say, oh, the signal is saying I should eat lighter, I should eat simpler because things are not feeling right, or everything feels really great and I, you know, have a more license to eat a broader and more complex diet.
Right. Beautiful. Well, we're about an hour and 15 minutes, and I'd like to have a little bit of time for questions and answers. If you have a question, press *6 on your phone, and then I'll bring you into the conversation, and we'll need to be done in about 10 minutes or so, but we do have time for a few questions. So if you have a question, press *6, and then in the meantime, just kind of to wrap up, I guess, you know, I know that it's that new practitioners and who are trying to make a living, they're seeing, or even experienced practitioners are seeing this way that I can make some money and this can do some good, and I think that's true. But we have to be really careful with how we're doing it. And the most important thing is to help people change their lives, not to detox. So I'm going to take this first question, and it's from a 514 area code, and
Hi,
I don't have a name. Hi, can you say your name again?
Sean Float.
Sean. So, Sean, just tell us where you're from and what your question is.
I'm from Southern Oregon, and my question first, just thank you for your time. This was very empowering and very helpful. I am not an Ayurvedic practitioner, but have been involved in a few mass cleanses, and it just gives a lot more clarity to the intent behind community cleanses. My question is in regards to reducing stressors. I'm starting to see where it's difficult for some people to reduce the stressors, but it's more valuable to sort of teach, and this may be more on an individual basis, but to inform people about how they cope with stress. And I'm starting to find some research that's way back from the 50s about this. But that's actually more important, is to find ways that people can cope differently with stressors. So I was curious if you have any ideas, Scott or Claudia, about that approach in the rejuvenation phase.
Yeah, that's brilliant, because really we all, you know, stress is in the eye of the beholder, right? I mean, there's a story of my guru's guru. When his son died, he made a cup of tea and offered it to the people who came in and were chatting and laughing. And then they found out his son died, and they were like, how can you be, you know, laughing? And it was just that he recognized that his relationship was over, and that was the natural flow of things. And most of us are not at that point where we could see a loved one die and take it in stride, much less, you know, many of us, the phone rings and we go, you know, and we get a stress response to little things, and we perceive benign events as threats, and it's a big deal. And this is a really long conversation. We could have a really long conversation about this, Sean. It's such a good question. But one of the things I think is absolutely true. I mean, you know, we can do what we can with external stressors. And I think there's a place for trying to shift external things. Like if you're in a job you hate for some reason that's not really, really good, then maybe get out of it, right? I think we often talk ourselves out of, we think we have to stay in a stressful situation that we don't really need to, or a situation that's causing us stress. But other than that, absolutely, learning how to deal with stress, and this is one of the reasons, you know, Dr. Scott mentioned my Prana CD that's on my website. I'm not trying to promote it, but it's why I did that. It's these visualizations for Prana and having it move smoothly in the body. Prana will not move smoothly in the body if there's stress. So. Yeah. Doing these practices with breathing, I think, is one of the most useful things in terms of not feeling events as stressful. And so those things are pretty universally okay for people. I would say if people are doing those exercises on that CD, to please start with number one, then go to number two, and then number three, and don't do number four until you're really comfortable with the first three. But they're pretty universally okay. And if you're pregnant and there's some difficulty with the pregnancy, then you might want to talk with someone who really knows breath to see what might be better for you. So I think the breath work is short answer. And I'm going to actually go on and take the next call here because we've got a few more. And I'd like to get to them, but I hope that answered pretty well, Scott. So whoever's from 760, could you just say your name, where you're from, and what your question is?
Hi, my name is Albert Lee, and I'm actually calling from Montreal.
Hi, Albert. Nice to hear you.
Hi, Claudia. How are you doing? I just wanted to thank you also for having this because I recently did start, organizing workshops and teaching people how to cleanse just based on my years of cleansing from like the schools that I attended or whatever. And it's just helped me get some more clarity because I did wonder about is this ethical? Is this safe? Like, am I doing the right thing and stuff? And so now I feel like going forward, I'm in a much better position. So I'm very grateful that you were able to offer this to us.
Oh, that's great. That's really great.
But my question is regarding, you said that, for doing a mass cleanse, that you wouldn't do all the steps of the Purvakarma and the Panchakarma and all that. But one of the places where I learned Ayurveda, one of the things that they did as part of the course was they gave us like what they called a home BK that included internal elevation and the Virechana and the Basti and all that. And so I just wanted to hear about maybe what you or Scott think about, someone who's a student of Ayurveda and practicing, if it's okay to do, something just beyond, the Dipana and Pachana, that's more like a home PK.
Yeah, and I'm going to keep my answer pretty brief, and maybe Scott will too, because we've got a few more questions. But it's a good, really good question, Albert. And one of the things is, if you're doing a home Panchakarma, if you're a student of Ayurveda and you've got resources to catch you when you run into trouble, I think that's different. I think that's a different story than putting something out on the internet, for example, and saying, "Hey, let's all do a Panchakarma together." That there's no safety net there. But for you, you had teachers to talk to, and you had a prescription, and you were seeing it through in a certain way. Whereas where you're going to run into trouble in mass cleanses is if you introduce, say, "Oh, well, let's throw in an enema here because that's probably going to be good," or castor oil virechana or something, without the whole preparation and the whole follow-up. But sounds like what you were doing, you had teachers and resources in place, and you already had a sense of how to live and eat. So I think there's a place for that if you have appropriate guidance, which sounds like you probably did. Scott, do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think that the context you're in is a very different context than most people would be in a group cleanse. And I also think that if you are a practitioner or a would-be practitioner, nowadays liability concerns have to be really, they always are present. And so you want to be really, really sure that what the can of worms you're opening, you can handle opening that can of worms. And so, like Claudia was saying, in the situation you're in, you were intentionally experimenting because you were a student. And with a lot of people, it's a totally different context and proposition. So as a practitioner you're opening yourself to that liability for every single person that you are taking responsibility for.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I know we've got two more callers and Scott's going to have to leave in about 5 minutes, but it's really worth saying, you know, I mean, I hate to introduce this into this conversation, but it's really true. You have to protect yourself. You have to be able to defend why you're doing everything. If someone gets in trouble, you have to be able to understand why you told them to do it, what your purpose was in mind, and why you knew it was safe for them. And it's just, you have to do that. And so, you know, it's an issue. And boy, you know, there is such a place. People need help knowing how to eat and how to live their daily lives. Forget about jumping into intense detox things. People really need, on a mass level, to know how to eat and live their lives. And so there's great places for this. And Albert, I'm really glad you're out there working with it so ethically, and it's good to hear from you. And I'm going to take Lisa off mute here. Lisa, nice to see you. And where are you calling from?
New Hampshire. I have two. Oops, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Just one observation is that I did the Yoga Journal cleanse last year off the time, like a little later, and learned a lot. I learned a lot of things that were in some cases negative. I think one of the big things that I just wanted to say is that although I was doing a good dinacharya, I was eating and I was in the flow, I didn't limit my activities during that time as much as I know I should have, and it had a negative effect. So I learned a lot. I know when I do this again, I'll recognize the importance of tapering down my workflow and really limiting what was happening on the rest of the day. But one question I have in brief about oleation is during the early phases, if you've got a significant amount of ama and you're saying it's okay to continue to do the abhyanga, can you just speak briefly about that?
That's a really good question, Lisa. So let's talk about that, but I want to give Scott a chance to talk about the Yoga Journal aspect of things and talk and just briefly comment on your point about limiting activities. This is so important. This is so important. I mean, doing a cleanse while you go to work, it's just asking for complications, and I think that limiting activities, and if you're doing panchakarma, there's no way you should be working. If you're doing internal oleation, do not be working, right? But if you are doing sort of a more gentle thing, just limiting the activities, I think, is great. And Scott, I know you have to leave momentarily, so can you speak to that aspect of things, and then we'll go to the next, that second part of the question.
Yeah, and I think it's a great comment, Lisa. Thanks for bringing it up, which is that what we did was when there were 7 days of emails that went out with it, and the first day, you know, the emphasis was saying that nowadays one of the biggest toxins is stress, is overwork. And so, you know, make as much time as possible for, you know, extra rest and relaxation, because you actually might find yourself feeling fatigue, and that can be a natural thing where the body is recognizing that, you know, there's an opening to get more rest, and that and that it is something that, even though, you know, again, people assume that they're, you know, making their lifestyle more moderate for that week of the cleanse, but it's not something people are acutely aware of, because it's so normal to be so active, you know. And so it's something that I think as practitioners, if you're guiding people, the important thing is to get, like, even on the verge of evangelical about it. Like, it's just like you have to just exalt the idea of relaxation, and because it's such an easy word to say, and people nod their heads, but there's this cultural momentum and this momentum with the Vata imbalance that make it so that the recognition of it and the actual, you know, doing of it sometimes are not the same thing. So it's like you kind of got to break through that somehow with the way that you emphasize it and exalt it in your explanation.
All right. Scott, do you need to leave right now, and I'll answer the second part of the question?
Sure, yeah, I do need to go.
I know you've got to go, and I'll answer the rest of this question, and then we'll all sign off together. But Dr. Scott, thank you so much for your time, and always a pleasure to be with you, and I think this has really been important, and your contribution is really, really valuable.
Yeah, same. It was great. It was great to be on, and I feel like, it's always so great to meet with other practitioners and hear people talk about the same things in different ways, and open up new vistas on stuff that you have a way of doing something and a way of looking at it, and then you hear about it from somebody else's eyes and perspective, and it's just great. So thank you, and thanks to everybody who turned up for the call.
Thanks, Scott. And Lisa, the second part of your question about doing Abhyanga even if there's ama, it's such a good question. I mean, in theory, right, they say you shouldn't do Abhyanga when you have ama. In practice, I've seen everybody do Abhyanga when there's ama. No matter which practitioner I've seen people suggest doing Abhyanga on a regular basis. And when I was having a similar conversation as today with my friend Sharon that I mentioned before, she said, "Are you kidding? There's nobody out there without ama." Now, of course, because as soon as she starts the whole Panchakarma process, she starts seeing the ama in people. So it's difficult to find, of course, if there's thick coating, then there's more ama. And that's if someone has a really thick coating, I might not have them do Abhyanga. But, here's the tricky thing. For instance, you've got someone with high vata and high stress. And if you've got high stress, which in Western terms, right, is high cortisol, when high cortisol is irrigating the system, there's no way you're going to digest food well, no matter what it is. Could be khichdi, could be nectar from the gods. Every Ayurvedic practitioner has sanctified it and said, this is for you. You've got an organic garden in your backyard and somebody's cooked it up with, mantras and fed it to you, and you still can't digest it because you can't digest things if you have high stress and high cortisol. Your digestive system kind of shuts down, and then you end up getting ama. So for that kind of person, it might be very useful to do some Abhyanga in order to sort of break the stress cycle, and other things like when Sean's question about managing stress. If they'd start doing some gentle breathing work, breathing techniques, and massage, then the vata can calm down, and they actually have a shot at digesting food. So again, it's certainly best to have one-on-one relationship with people to determine whether Abhyanga is okay for them, but if the people have gone through something like we've talked about, where they go through a prep for the prep kind of thing, where they have cleaned up their diet and they know how to live and they know how to eat, then the assumption is they're not starting with a huge amount of ama, and that Abhyanga is going to be overall pretty beneficial. So I hope that answered that question pretty well, and we're at an hour and a half here, and so let's, if we can just take just a quiet 30 seconds or something just to absorb this information. And please know that I'm sure it was not Dr. Scott's intention, and I'm sure it's not mine to bring anybody to task if you have been doing these things, or to criticize people who are. This is really our opinions and are based on our experience, and it's meant to sort of, like Sean said, be empowering. I'm really glad to hear that, Sean and Albert and whoever else felt that. And because that's the intention, is to empower, to, how this can work well and how to protect yourself from it, as well as your patients or clients, how to protect yourself and them from things going poorly. So I hope things work really well with everybody, and I hope this was useful. And let's just take a couple of seconds here, and then we can sign off. But just to sort of lovingly absorb this information and the good parts, and let go of parts that feel sticky, and just arrive at this moment. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for being here. And what I'm going to do is unmute you for a moment. So you're all on now, so we can just all say goodbye. This will be this is recorded and will be on my website pretty soon. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. Bye.
Thank you. Bye. Bye. Thank you. Bye. Thank you.